detail, but...
Well, you see, I was a Swiss subject, so I could not have been called up.
Because Switzerland was neutral.
Yes, neutral, yes, it was quite. But I went into it quite deeply and quite fully. This country had a British Empire. I think the British Empire was the best thing that ever happened to the world. United the world in many, many ways. Many, many poor people in poor countries. Well, they weren't treated very well, I'm afraid, especially in the early days, but they got a new way of life, medicine, education. Re-educate them because they could work for us. I mean, India, for example. There's many Indian people who want to throw us out. They got their independence. As you know, Gandhi, he got their independence and never fired a shot. He moved about 600 or 800 million people to claim independence.
Yeah.
And I was there when that happened. But some of the young Indian people, they were very anti-British. That upset me because we were giving our lives away in Burma and all over the world against the Nazis and the Russia and the Japs or whatever. I said, do you think designed always our ways? You built them because you have the labour, but you didn't have the know-how. India's railways are some of the most crazy railways in the world. I know, I've been on them. They go places trains can't go. They do things, and when it goes wrong, they get out and get a bit of string and get a bit of wire and get a bit of timber and bend it and shape it and kick it and and spit on it, and the train goes. You don't know. No, when you get on the phone there and we've broken down, we mustn't break down.
Well, it's just that mentality, or that, when needs must, isn't it?
So yes, that's right.
Fix things.
The train won't go.
To hand.
Well, why won't it go? Well, where does one go around? Have you got any steam? No, I didn't have a little steam then. But you had a gauge. You know, they sort of haggled one another. I've been on the trains with them. I had to travel Indian trains. I travelled millions of miles all over India. Never paid a penny fare. Just got on the train, pulled out my machine gun. Sub cheese, Joe. That means everybody out. And so I pointed the gun and all got off the train. I locked all the doors and all the windows and I had the whole carriage to myself. It would have killed me if I didn't watch. And I don't know who were pro-British and who aren't.
Was that after the war?
No, during the war.
During the war.
I travelled in the new, when you got to the station, a little chicker, a little boy, 8, 10, would come out the window, Connor Munter's up, took the food. Oh, chicker, oh yeah. And what have we got? And he'd tell me, yeah, I'd order it. And I'd sign, Charlie Chaplin. Sir Henry Ford, or whatever. I mean, how on earth they ever kept that bloody country out? I do not know. If you have a system like that and a person like me, I'm going to take advantage of it.
Well, that's just quite harmless, isn't it? I mean, signing a joke name. I mean, I'm sure there were different, there were probably people that did things very differently, but...
But I mean, I got on my bearer. Now, to be a bearer to a British soldier, you had to be in the army until you retired, with a good record. And you looked after me, you're my bearer. Mustn't touch my weapons, that's not allowed. When I left India, my bear stood on the pier and shed tears. I got up leaping. And I felt very upset too. He'd been with me all over India.
And what period of time? For what period of time were you two together?
Oh. most people went out to Burma and just stayed there. I was all over the flipping place.
Was that because of the particular sort of... battalion or...
See, what was he? When a new officer came in, a new officer, especially a major or a senior rank, I would chat him up. Because, most people come out and never been in the jungle, to start with. So there's a person here who had been in the jungle for a couple of years or what, and he's got quite a good reputation, quite a record of reliability and so on. And you'd be surprised how many officers who were quite posh and all that had to kowtow to people like me, if they want to stay alive. And that's come out, most amazing, ridiculous thing that has come out with. Like, as you get flown back to India, I come out with an idea of some kind. Never get a bloody work. I want to go back to India after being there a few days and had a bit of a rave up. I think, no, I don't think it's going to work out. No, I don't think enough people to subscribe to it or whatever, and that was it. And I got away from them for years. I can't really see, you didn't speak, this must be done the same. When you're a soldier, you don't speak to an officer. He's only a one pipper, 17 years old, coming straight from England. His knees are still white. You don't speak to him, unless he speaks to you. No, I ignored all that.
A couple of weeks ago, they'd organised a little chat, a talk down at the Broccoli Social Club about Spike Milligan.
Oh, yeah.
And we played some video as part of that, including some interviews with him. And he must be familiar with Spike Milligan's years during the army. And he wrote these very famous books about how ridiculous he found serving in the army. Yeah. And he talked about, I mean, you just have to humour me here. He said the funniest thing that happened to him during the war was when they were, I think, at somewhere in a basic training camp somewhere here in the UK, and they'd all got off the train. And they were all being lined up, and the senior officer was sort of telling them what to do and what to do. And he said, and Spike Milligan said something, and he said the senior officer sort of stood there and shouted, he said, "Silence when you're talking to an officer." And this was the one thing that Spike Milligan could remember. He said, "That sums up the army."
He broke off my heart. I was liking him in many ways, but I wasn't much a comedian, although I do have many moments. I used to get things done. I mean, officers used to come to me and say to me, "Arthur, we've got a problem there with such and such a thing. We've got no supplies in this, we're money low on shelled and blah, 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 blah. What do you want me all to do?" And this is a major or captain or whatever. "What do you want me all to do?" I'll speak among a few of my friends. I'll get back to you, sir. Thank you.
So what rank were you at this stage?
Sergeant.
Oh,
full sergeant. I wouldn't go any higher. I'll try and have it over. That was the nicest response to a job. You don't want to get in high in that room because you can only carry too many bucks. And I'd disappear. Then I'd go on to another camp, get chatting with the stores manager there and so on. I knew so many people. Just crazy. And I'd come back with a lorry full of shells. I commandeered them. With a bit of paper, nothing on it. Just got a bit of paper and say, "Oh yeah, good Lord dear, 625 25 pounders, and blah, 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 blah. Okay, you load them on the lorry there." Wasn't in my lorry, just a lorry in the car park. No driver, and I waited one, no one come up to it, no engine was cold. And I loaded the lorry up, and I signed there, Charlie Brown and General Lord Montgomery, whatever. And I went back to camp, and I worked in the camp. "What have you got there?" "Got 625 25 pound shells." "How the hell are you going to get them in? We've been trying for bloody months." "You seem to think I'm the right people, didn't you? Most word gets round." Do you remember Dad's Army? Remember the Spiv? Mm. Dad's Army? Mm. He can get some candles, he can get all manner of things. You know, he knew someone who knew somebody. It's the same, not quite the same thing, but he knew to go to.
But you were different to being. You were making things happen out where were fighting, and people like him were kind of
they were a bit dodgy.
When they were sort of the black market back here in the UK selling.
We had no food. We were months without a supply of food, and you can live in a jungle up to a point, but a lot of food in the jungle is poisonous. Certainly not good for your health, I'll tell you that. And I'm sure I told you, I found this out when I first went out there. Because I learned from the local people. First of all, I did go and have the local kids. Give them a few sweeties. Serve a song. Give them a mess tin or something like that. No great value, but I got a mess tin. Look at all polished. And from that, you can find out almost anything. And there were lots of things that most of it's common sense. If you go out to the jungle and you see this growing on a tree and looks very tasty, is it safe to eat? The little chico said, "Well, sub, Dakai," and he threw it out to the monkey. The monkey threw it back. "Don't you eat it. If he eats it, it's okay. You know, it's so, so simple.
When you know.
Ah, yeah, yeah. Mm. And I learned, I passed on what I learned. Mm. And every now and again, I stick my finger in and upset the whole military system. We normally would go forward with 3 or 4 guns. It's very different in the jungle, 10 guns. They weigh 3 tons each. You've got to lug them everywhere. And being a sergeant, I didn't do the lugging. And I said to this officer who came up with us, he's a one pippy, didn't know which end of the gun was which, I don't think. I said, I might make a suggestion, sir. I'm going to have a couple of thoughts. We normally fire about 5 rounds and limber up and go like bloody hell before they start shooting back at us. But they've been out there a long time, these chaps. And they're all the places where guns, there's not many places you can assemble guns. The jungle train, they're quite a thick place to go through. I said, this time, after you fire 5 rounds, how about moving forward half a mile or so, and give another 5 rounds? They expect us to be running away. And they're firing shells where we should be, but we're half a mile nearer. I can't want some wacky answer like that. And because he took all the blame, all the kudos for it, you know. No, I was never mentioned. But I can't have lots of ideas. So I like living. And I find that even with the sultans and sultanas and maharajas, those sort of people, they speak better English than most other people. I was frightfully posh when I was in the army. They want to make me an officer. But he said, I'd go about it the wrong way. I was told, report to headquarters. So I go in. Gunning is Dottie, sir. 1454251, Gunning is Dottie, AL. And he said, do you want to be an officer? Yes or no? And I said, well, I just got here to India. I'm in the biggest camp in the world. Something like 4 million men assembled a place called Kalyan. There's no means of a bigger assembly of men ever in history. Every nationality in the world was there. From Fijians to Hawaiians to Americans and all sorts. All going into war in the Far East. I've done that. I do occasionally. I lose the trend.
You were talking about that they went the wrong way to ask you to be an officer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I should have gone and said, now, you have had a good education, Gunner Kadotti. Yes, sir. You were top of your whole school 3 or 4 years running. I was all in the top 3. And you learn things like some people drink their beer. I said, all right, fine. I have a nosy mind, sir. I'd like to know why that gun goes bang and then shh, shh, bang. I want to know why. You're sitting on a seat there. £25 down, and I'm sitting on the seat and I've got my hand on the firing lever, and right alongside me is the breech, and inside there's the shell. I pull the lever and nothing happens, and someone shouts out, stand fast, misfire. I've now got a shell that's smoking inside the breech, and now the man who's got it lower the gun, he unloaded the breech very, very slowly, grab hold of the shell, run like bloody mad as far as he can and dump it.
In case it goes off.
It's smoking. Yeah. It's a misfire, is it? When you put one up on the lever, the firing pin, the centre, like, you know, the firing pin of a bullet, which is the same with a shell. If it's been offset, the firing pin will miss it and just hit nearby. And it's smoke.
So does that mean that the shell will explode
almost certainly. It might.
It just means that it hasn't fired out. That's right. So it's right.
It might go out, but the chance is very, very high. But it's going to go off.
Well, it's a bit like I know it's on a completely different scale. The whole thing of never go back to a lit firework. It's the
that's
same.
Right,
principle,
it is.
You know, on a much more terrifying scale.
I had to sit faster. I still remember all the orders, the guns. HE-119 Charge 3. Angler's light, 105 degrees. Aiming point, tree, top of hill. 255 degrees. And you're putting all this into a cone, a large cone, and all sorts of buttons and levers and handles. And when it's all done, number one gun, ready, sir. Number one gun, fire! But while I've been doing all this, all the other guns, usually 12 or more of them, have all been doing exactly the same as I have. All the guns were being aimed the same as mine. But instead of wasting 12 shells, you fire one. The aiming point sees the shell land hit right on target, fire, 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 all guns fire about 5 rounds each, load up and get out bloody quick. Because wherever you fire, the enemy always know roughly where you are. Mm. There aren't many places you can assemble more than one or two guns in one place.
So did that mean then that you were, you had sort of, you were in charge of one gun, generally speaking? That was your, one of your responsibilities?
Well, I was usually on number one gun. There's 6 men with a gun. One's on the seat. No, one's on the trail. He moves the trail around back and forwards. Number two is me on the seat. Number three is the man on the load. Number four and five are ammunition, or an ammunition truck behind us. And they're listening all the time. They come down the tannoy. HE-119, cap on. Now, if cap on, that's going to explode in the air. It'll explode a certain half of the ground it's set.
Oh, so that's a setting for the shell.
That's right, that you're about to cap, you've got a cap on it, so that won't go off until it gets to a certain point and a certain height. Mm. Take the cap off, it explodes on impact. Mm. So you want a shell to go off at 50 feet above the ground over a load of advancing troops, you left the cap on and set the timing device. Mm. It's quite technical. Mm. But like everything else, it's... I could do it. You know, if you blindfolded me and put me a 25-pounder, I bet I could bloody load it and aim it up like yesterday.
I'm sure. I mean, you do something like that for any length of time when the pressure's on, you know, and you've got to get it absolutely right, you know.
It's, as a young lad, in some ways, it's quite exciting. I think there's some element that there was some certain element of excitement in it in some ways. Although, sometimes you stop to think about how dangerous the whole thing was. But you see, there was a time once when I was told through my brigadier, such being a brigadier's driver most of the time, that they allow me to let them get on with it and make gunfire war. I'd come back for a while and look after them. Then we'd go and visit a few bar jars and Mara bar jars and what have you. And it's quite exciting life, really. But you certainly saw life, I'll tell you. Mm. You see, life hasn't changed. If you go today to an Indian Maharaja's palace, you're going about 800 years in life. It hasn't changed. I mean, I went there once with my brigadier, and the Maharaja came down. I knew most of them, you know, very respectful. He said, "Would you like to go down the harem?" I said, "That's very interesting." He said, "Of course, as your guide here will explain to you, there are a few snags, of course, as you appreciate. They're my wives." Yeah, I appreciate that, certainly. So after he'd gone, what's all that? He's been, "We're going down here, and they will look after you. They'll bathe you and anoint you and Christ knows what else, but you mustn't touch them. And standing at the door of the harem are 2 men like you see on the films, but 9 foot tall, with a sword about 8 foot long. My God, they were big, I tell you. They chopped your bloody head off." So I went down, I was pampered and spoiled, and looked after. I came out, oh dear, spending time learning. Prostitute's bourgeois, I think, the time I come out. Oh, I did live in luxury, but they were his wives. They were anything 20 to 100 of those. Anything like going down, I'm doing right on here, but I should be so lucky. Mm-hmm. No, I wouldn't take any chances, don't worry. But I had a man at the palace, and you got pearls on the floor, the carpets and pearls, beautiful pearls, and people walk on them in hobnail boots. The dome on the palace weighs nearly a ton, solid gold. And they're living as their ancestors lived. Mm. And they got the right of life and death over hundreds of thousands of people. Mm. And if you're an officer, a high-ranking officer, you keep in with them because you want them to be on your side, but you can't tell them what to do. You only ask. It's very tricky, I tell you.
That makes sense. So where did you train?
I trained in Glasgow. At Mary Hill Barracks.
Tell me a bit about that. How long was the training?
That was quite exciting. I'm on the train, of course. I come in, I've got a bloody great suitcase. and five to Posh Spoken. That wasn't exactly an asset at the time. I'm a tough old bird. I've done nothing to anybody. And I was quite ahead in my fists. I took my own, yeah, and you must come out of a fight. Wasn't all the markers of Queensbury either. But you find if you don't overdo it, you'd be surprised how quickly you start making friends. Because you are a person who has education. A lot of these people were very uneducated. They couldn't have two and two together. They were cannon fodder. I was never going to be cannon fodder. I was going into war and I was going to use my intelligence, my common sense. And I know a lot of rules are not in the book, I can tell you that. So I got to get things done. I've got to do things that no one else seemed to be able to do. That's not boasting, it's just a case of, it's amazing how an officer, a major, will listen to you. And you're that's a gunner. Because he's simple enough to realise you have this knowledge, this know-how. And not to listen to you would be a bit foolish, because that would be turned to his advantage. He would get the credit, not me.
So do you remember sort of how long your training was and the sort of things you did? Yeah, six
weeks it lasted.
And what was a typical day?
Oh boy, up about 6:30. Out, and it's quite cold out there too. Out in your singlet, a little pair of trunks and a singlet. You have a five mile run in hobnail boots, and I've never worn boots in my life. But if you dropped out, you're letting the team down. A lorry followed the big men running around, you see. And I ran until my feet bled. But I thought, no way they're going to give in. Come back then, you're bathing, you've got blood everywhere, but, you know, after a while you just get hardened to it. Then we had a 25-mile forced march. That's run for about a mile, walk very quickly for a mile, and so on for 25 miles. When you get to the other end, bull guy, that's 25 miles from the middle of Glasgow. We went to the hand grenade range, and we threw our first grenades. And I'm there, everybody, he threw it straight up in the air. Oh dear, I think I aged about 20 years there that day, I'll tell you.
It's a live one.
Oh yeah, live, yes, oh, yeah. So they got a big pit. There was a pole in the middle down the bottom of the pit. And you're supposed to throw, so your grenade lands somewhere near the base of the pole. That gives you range. And I found it quite easy. I mean, my mathematical mind just rub it over. And a bloody grenade coming down. I got down very quick, I'll tell you. And then you go on the range, you're a Sten gun. The Sten guns are the most dangerous guns in the world. They kill more of the owners than they did the enemy. The Pershers had them. When they jumped, as they landed, they went off. No safety catch. You pulled the bolt back and had a little notch. But when you jumped out the notch and started firing. And some of us walking up the range, and you're supposed to be firing single shots, by single or automatic. He turned around with it, "Sarge! I can't even stop shooting." And everybody's dropping those lines going, "Oh, bloody hell." Oh, he did get a loonies, I tell you. Having won the war, I do wonder sometimes. But there was a time once I found out from my brigadier, I was supposed to be on the Japanese hit list. All sorts of things I've been getting up to, mischief in it. And that worried me a bit, I must be honest. When you've got about 50,000 or 100,000 Japs looking for you to cut your throat. So I kept my eyes peeled. And then I came home. I didn't stay in London. I moved all around the country for a couple of years. I mean, I took the threat seriously.
What year would this have been?
I came home 1950.
Oh, right, so you'd stayed on in India for all that time.
Oh, yeah.
And what, without coming back for breaks? Just literally?
Well, no, because I was unmarried. If you're married, you get a certain amount of priority. What is it called that now? Special, maybe they add initials, you know. Python. I remember it's called Python. So about leave in addition to additional leave. It's like a lottery. An officer's supposed to, the same as men, win in a bag and they sort it out, and he could be a general pulled out, he could be a gunner. I think it needs to be fair. That was Python. That was leave in addition to only leave. I never had any leave. But see, I'm not a single man. A few of my families back, but I came back first. Most of them came back in 1946. The war was over officially in 1946. In 1948, I was still fighting the Japanese in Burma. And in 1960 and 1970, every now and again, the Americans came across an armed group of Japanese in the 80s and 90s, or whatever, who were still holding up somewhere, who wouldn't accept the war was over.
I know that that's happened on a few of the Pacific Islands, isn't it?
Oh, still quite
very
few.
Occasionally find...
When you get a group of people who are told that their emperor, Hirohito, wasn't a man, he was God. Mm. He came down from the heavens. And if you looked upon him, that was your death. So when he rode through the streets of Tokyo, everybody went down with their heads on the ground. And if you looked up, and you were seen to do that, they shot your head off. You must not look upon the emperor. Only the very highest of the high could do that. And they were taught right from birth that their whole duty in life was to live and die for the emperor. So it wasn't very difficult. People become kamikaze and whatever. And in battle, I mean, they met tens of thousands but wouldn't surrender. And the Japanese, when the Americans took some of the islands, Okinawa and all those islands of the Pacific, they suffered very heavy casualties. And they didn't take prisoners. About 3,000 or 4,000 women and children committed suicide in one island because they've been told that the American troops would rape all the women and kill all the children. So they jumped off the cliff, thousands of them.
So where was your first campaign? So after you had your training in Glasgow, what happened next? After that 6 weeks?
Well, after Glasgow, I went to Thetford in Norfolk on the 5.5. You ever seen the guns? One like this, we have very high posts each side of the gun. They call long tons. The barrel is 5.5 inches. Quite a big gun. It fires about 25 to 30 miles. And it's got two huge, great springs. And when the gun fires, it bounces up and down. And it's got two great posts. They're quite, if you ever see one of those, you never forget it. They put me up on those in Norfolk, Thetford, for about 6 weeks. And then we did the impossible. We got on a train at Thetford in Norfolk and went straight down to Exeter. And that's not possible. In those days, there was Southern Railway, London North Eastern, London Midland Scottish, Great Western. They were all separate railways. They all had their own railways, their own carriages, everything. And you, officially or physically, you couldn't really do that. We got on the train, all windows blacked out. When we got out, it was an extra station. Went to Topton Barracks. We were there for another couple of weeks, bandit drill and a lot of nonsense, you know, all usual rubbish. And they took us to Liverpool on board ship. And we got on the ship, the Duchess of Bedford. She belonged to the Canadian Pacific Railways. She was flat bottom. Because the river in the St. Lawrence River is very shallow. And she's known as a drunken duchess. And we sailed down through the Bay of Biscay, because by doing that, you got submarines. They had half a submarine to operate in the Bay of Biscay because of the bad weather. And I was the only person on board who wasn't seasick. And I was going down to the mess there, eating like a lord. Everything rationed. One cob of bread, one pat of butter, one this, one that. And I think I've got a couple of eggs, I have 4 rashers of bacon. Oh, that is lovely. And then I started asking some of the, this is where I got myself, nearly got myself thrown overboard. I'm on board ship here, and when I first joined the ship, before we sailed, I got one of the two young lads, and they had a crew, and I picked their brains. As you see, I'm a soldier on there. What's a good thing? Ship's peace. Get on the ship's beach, you can go anywhere in the ship except the beach. Main quarters, the bridge, not the bridge, main quarters, engine room, you can go anywhere in the ship. You can arrest the captain if he's up on deck and lights a cigarette. Because at some mean 5 miles away, we'll see a match strike on the top deck of a ship. And 4,000 men go to their death because somebody daft enough to light a fag up on deck. I quite like that. I like my lady friends, and there were lots of ladies on board, lots of Greek nurses and Egyptian nurses, Maltese, all going back to their to reinforce our own countries. And I got quite friendly with one of these Greek nurses. Then she found out I was quite friendly with one of the Egyptian nurses, and I got a stab wound in my shoulder. She stabbed me with a fruit knife. Thought it was only a fruit knife. That caused a nice thing, didn't it? As you cover all his blood and oh dear, dear.